Peter Harris plays certain memories about his partner, Paul Rushworth, on repeat. Again and again, he recalls visits to Coogee Beach, swimming in the water beside each other, or sometimes watching from the sand as Paul emerged from the sea, wiping water from his face, refreshed and exhilarated. Ever since Paul went missing, Peter spends his time wondering where he is, who he's with, and whether he's well and happy. Sydney is home to 28 years of shared memories, so he sees Paul everywhere, at train stations, street corners, and all of the myriad locations they used to meet at. Every night, he imagines Paul walking through the door in his favourite jeans and maroon shirt, closing it with a sigh behind him, his pilgrimage over. He's alive. He's come back. And he's glowing.
There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. Islands can be big and small, my love, for you will never go away.
Paul Rushworth grew up in Lapston, in the Blue Mountains, west of Sydney. He loved living so close to nature and attended the local primary school. But his father passed away when he was young and his mother had to move to Penrith in Western Sydney, where the cost of living was cheaper. In 2013, Paul was 46 years old and resided with his partner, Peter Harris, in a unit on Baronia Street in the inner city suburb of Redfern. Paul and Peter had been together for 28 years. Paul is artistic. He likes a bit of everything, including screen printing, painting, and photography. One of his favourite things to do is to go out for breakfast with Peter and then take a walk around the Art Gallery of New South Wales before walking through the Sydney Botanical Gardens. At the time of his disappearance, Paul was completing a second master's degree in fine arts on a full scholarship. If you talked to his supervisors, they would have told you that Paul was excelling. One went so far as to say that if all of her students were as advanced as Paul, she'd be laughing. But Paul, a perfectionist, wasn't convinced. If something wasn't exactly right, he'd do it again and again and again. No matter how good others thought his work was, he always believed it could be better. So even though his supervisors thought his work was brilliant, Paul was deeply stressed about his studies. In fact, he was so worried that he started to struggle with his mental health. On Wednesday, September 11, 2013, Paul had lunch with his partner, Peter.
Well, yes, Paul and I used to meet every Wednesday for lunch. I'd be in town for work, so we'd meet up, have lunch sometimes up at his uni where he was. Sometimes we'd meet closer to home. This day we'd met closer to home, up the road. We had lunch, he seemed fine. We chatted, talked about his master's degree, what he should be looking at, what he could be doing. And he didn't seem stressed or over-anxious or anything. But I drove him home again. Well, we walked, actually walked home. Walked home to the unit. And I said, I've got to go back to work, as I naturally have to do every day, every Wednesday. And he said, do you want to come up for a little while? And I said, well, no, I've got to go back to work. You know that, Paul. So I went back to work. About an hour later, I get a phone call from the unit, and it's the police. And I said, surprising. I said, what's going on? And they told me that Paul had been in contact with Lifeline, and he was a little bit stressed and that, but, and a little bit worried, and they obviously were worried enough to send and call the police. And I told them, well, okay, look, I'll be home in half an hour. got in the car, came home. I opened the door. No one's there. No one's there except Paul. He's on the lounge. He seems okay. Not overstressed or anything like this. And we just sit down there and talked for a while, and just general stuff, nothing specific or anything like this. And then we just thought we made dinner together and went to bed. And in that time, I think the person from Lifeline had organised Paul to see this counsellor or psychologist at the Redfern Health Centre the next day. Didn't talk anything about that. I said, okay, we'll go and see that. It was early in the morning. I'll take you down together.
The next day, Thursday, September 12, 2013, Paul was still struggling. With Peter's encouragement, he visited a clinical nurse at the mental health unit in Redfern.
We turn up there. The actual doctor who we were hoping to see wasn't. She was away on leave for a week. So we said, okay. It was a clinical nurse there, and so she said, Paul went in there and said, do you want me to come with you? I'll come in. And he says, no. Do you want me to wait for you? What's up to you? What do you want to do? I can go wait here for you, or I can go back to work and you can give me a call and I come straight home. And he said, no, look, I'll be right. I'll walk home. It's only half a kilometre up the road. He does that and he walks home and he gives me a call, and I could hear in his voice he was upset. I said, okay, look, I'll be home. I'm coming. I'll come straight home. So I got in the car, came back home again, and you could see he was stressed. And I said, well, what did she say to you? And she said, well, basically she said, I've got to really take control of my life myself, and it's going to take a lot of work, a lot of effort by me. You know what I'm saying? That's what his voice, what he's got out of it. Whether or not that's what's actually happened is what he's told me. I said, well, what would you like to do this afternoon, the rest of the day? I said, do you like? We can go down to Coogee if you like. We can either go for a swim, sit down there and just have a look, do nothing.
Paul loved going for a swim at Coogee Beach, and after some umming and aahing, he took Peter up on his offer.
We drive down the Coogee on the way. I specifically drive past the Prince of Wales Hospital. I turned into the hospital and I say to Paul, look, Paul, we can go in here together. Obviously, we can find someone in here that can help, a doctor or something who can put us in the right direction, and we can go from there. No. I'm fine. No, I don't want to do this.
They made their way to the beach, had an ice cream each, and then returned home where they cooked dinner together. But Paul was still agitated. He started saying that the police were going to come and knock the door down, then take him away because he was a Fruit Loop. Peter told him that was ridiculous and continued to try and settle Paul. But Paul remained anxious throughout the night. The next morning of Friday, September 13, Paul got up early at about 6 a.m., which was unusual for him. He had a shower, got dressed, and then told Peter he was going to go see a doctor. When Peter replied that it was too early and there'd be no doctors open yet, Paul agreed and said he'd go for a walk around the block instead. He even said that he'd email his sister, who was living in England, when he got back from his walk. Peter didn't sense that anything was wrong.
I said, you can't go to the doctors anyway. Anyway, I'll go with you if we're going to do that. There's no way I'm going to let you go on your own. We'll go together. And he said, well, look, I'll just go for a walk. I'll go for a walk around the block and I'll come back. And thinking about it, he said to me, is it cold outside? I said, well, it's pretty cool outside. I'd take it. Yeah, you'll need your jumper on if you're just going for a walk. So he put his jumper on and he was at the door. And he saw me. I was in the kitchen. I was getting his breakfast cereal bowl out and that and everything else. And he at the door and he looked at me and that top funny look on your face. And he said, and then he just said, okay, I'll see you later. And he said goodbye and he took his keys and then and his wallet, but just went. He just went for a, I thought he was only going for a walk. Well, you know, 7:30 comes. No, Paul anyway. I said, oh, God. I said, where is he?
Peter jumped in his car and went looking for Paul. He drove around the block, then checked out all of the local doctor surgeries, thinking Paul may be waiting for one of them to open. But there was no sign of him.
I get ready for work quickly, and I start going to the doctors around, the ones that are close and handy, and thinking, well, he's not there, that's there close, and the only one was open. So then I go home, and I'm just waiting, and I don't know what to do. So I'm waiting there, then I get a phone call at about the 8:00 mark. I said, where are you? And he says, I'm at Wynyard. I'm saying, what are you at Wynyard? And he says to me, look, I think I might just go up the mountains and clear my head. And I said, well, yeah, that's okay, but why? He said, look, if you want to go, we can go together. I'll drive you up there. We'll drive up there. Then I heard in the background a whistle. And I says, Paul, you're not at Wynyard, are you? You're down at Circular Quay, because I can hear the ferry whistle in the background. And he says to me, no, I'm at Wynyard.
But the ferry whistle in the background convinced Peter that Paul was at Circular Quay. You can't hear the ferry whistles from Wynyard Station.
Then I'm talking to him and says, look, Paul, are you all right? Look, I can pick you up. And we had a bit of a talk, and I said, I can pick you up. We can go and find a doctor. We can do anything we like. We can find someone. We can go together. We'll get help. There's people there to help. And he says, no, look, I'll just go up the mountains and I'll clear my head. Well, okay. That's hard to say, okay. Nothing. What else can I say? Okay. I wasn't exactly sure where he was or how. Time I would have got there anyway, he wouldn't have been there. Okay. Well, I said, well, once you get up there, give me a call. I know you haven't got your mobile because it was playing up. And I haven't got the mobile, but there's phones on the station. There's phones in the little town there. You've got money on you. You can call. Well, that was it. No call. No nothing.
That was the last known contact anyone has had with Paul. Later that day, Peter contacted the police. Officers checked CCTV from Circular Quay, Wynyard and Lapston stations, as well as other stations in the Blue Mountains, but there was no sign of Paul on any of the footage. He didn't get off at Lapston Station, the place where he said he was going, at least not on that day. When Paul left home that morning, he had only his house keys and wallet. Neither of those items have ever been located. His bank accounts haven't been touched either. Although Paul was anxious and stressed in the lead up to his disappearance, it was completely out of character for him to leave without saying a word. Peter will join me in the studio after this word from our sponsors. And now Peter joins me in the studio to talk about Paul's disappearance. Where to begin? It is so enormous, this journey that you've been on for too many years now. I read something that you had been quoted as saying, I think it was an article back in 2015, and you said, I exist as nothing. Life is not the way it used to be. And it's heartbreaking. Is that how you still feel now? Is it getting easier with time, or do you feel that life is merely an existence and you're not living anymore?
It's basically, that's it. It's still the same. Nothing's changed. Nothing will. It'll always be there until we either find Paul or I pass away. It's not going to change. I talk to Paul every night going to bed, say goodnight, I say a prayer for him. I'm not religious anyway, but I still say a prayer for him and talk to him, sometimes tell him what's happening today and tell him that I love him every night.
And that's how you keep that connection
Yes.
strong, it's still there. This impacts a life in so many different ways. What's an example of the day-to-day, you know, since Paul disappeared, things like life admin? I mean, you were together for 28 years. You would have had accounts together. How has this impacted you in an administrative way, in a financial way?
Well, tell the truth, with Paul and I, we type of kept things separate. Paul was on his own. He had no family here. He had no other one, no one else. It was my family and our family. So an actual, the unit that we lived in, it belonged to me and brother and a sister. And Paul type of paid him, but he didn't want to be on deeds or anything because he had no one to leave it to anyway. So he was happy to leave the way it was. He had his bank accounts, he used his money, I used my money. When we wanted to do something, we put it together and just do it that way. And he was happy doing that too. So that wasn't an issue. We just had no really arrangement or anything. It just financial wise, no, this hasn't been an issue. But I could see it being a big issue for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I think years ago you told me something about how you were still paying for his, I think it was private health insurance.
Yes.
You still are now?
No, because what was happening is that he had direct debit or credit card and the money was coming out of his credit card all the time. Now, I couldn't stop that. There was no way I could stop the money coming out of his credit card, off his credit card. So every month I would have to go in and pay the credit card, keep paying the credit card. So I'd be paying his health fund. I even spoke to the health fund and I said, well, is there any way we can stop this happening until Paul comes back and we can pick it up again? And they said, no, we can't. The only one who can stop it is Paul. And I was saying, yeah, but Paul's missing. Do you understand? Paul's missing. No, we can't stop it. So the only time it stopped was when his card ran out. The date on the card ran out, which was probably, 4 years on or something or other. I was paying it all the time.
Oh, gosh.
So you can think there's close to probably $200 a month, every month for 4 years, you paid that.
And on top of everything else, people in your position don't need that. It's just another thing to deal with. And I think that, understandably, the public wouldn't think about that. But it does have an enormous flow-on effect financially, socially. How did you find the adjustment to when Paul had been missing a few days, a few weeks, a few months? What was your social life like when Paul was here with you, and what's it been like since? How's that been adjusted?
When Paul was with us, and we did a lot of things together, and we'd go out constantly, do things down the city, shopping, go here, the movies, go have dinner, go sushi here somewhere like this, go swimming, then have breakfast somewhere and all the time. Now, tell the truth, I haven't been swimming at Coogee since Paul left. I haven't been swimming at the pools either. I haven't actually been to a pool since Paul left. I just don't do it. I just, I suppose in a way I've just become more just family oriented, brothers, sisters, mum, and we just support each other and work from there. I'll be honest, I don't go out a lot. I don't go out. Go to the farm with the family and we do family things and that's my life. I talk to some old friends and that, and we eventually meet up every now and then for a coffee or a meal or something or other, but they got their own lives to lead and they understand, but it's finding time. You just, there may be time, but in your head you're probably not motivated to do it.
So do you feel like it's changed the way that you see yourself? Like, do you still, if people were to ask, are you in a relationship? How do you see yourself? Are you still a partner? How do you disconnect? Do you make that identity change?
You disconnect, your type of thing. You become that single person again in the corner on their own type of thing. And you think, that's just the way it is. And even when we had family things and we'd all get together and Paul would be with us all the time. Now he's not, and you look around and Paul was always fun with the family and that and doing things, even down to doing up the farm where we used to do Easter egg hunts for the adults and things like this as well. He'd be well into that as well, and things like this. We'd be doing all those things together, but now we don't even do that type of thing anymore. It's the top of we do it for the kids and that a bit. And but it's all top of just changed and become that single person.
So do you think it's made your bond with your family members stronger? Has it changed the dynamic of your own family since Paul's not been there?
No, the bond has always been there. It's always been strong. We are family orientated, so it's always been strong. Probably more in their life now, I suppose, and you're more involved in every day running and doing things around the place and everything like this. But I no longer live at the unit. I've moved back. Back with looking after mum and helping mum and that, the other brothers and that, and my nephew and his wife live at the unit where Paul and I was. After Paul had been gone for a few years, the unit had been empty. I thought it was just silly having the place empty. Someone should be using it. So my other nephew was a builder, so he renovated it all for us. And then my niece and her husband moved in first, and then they moved out. My other nephew and his wife moved in, so they look after it and keep it going. And then I thought that was better. If Paul ever came back, I'll be honest, we never changed the locks or anything like this, so Paul can walk through the door anytime he likes, turn the key, and it'll look a bit different, but it'll still be home. He's still got paintings of his hanging on the wall. Bits and little bits and pieces still there that the nieces and nephew wanted and left there.
I think that's a consideration that lots of families have in this situation. They fear leaving the property that their loved one was living in prior to their disappearance in case they come back and they can't get in or they can't find them. So it's great that you've still got family living there. How is it for you when you go over and visit in that place?
Again, I don't go over a lot. I go over and visit and I look at it and say, oh, yeah. And the memories come back and you sit there and you look in and you see the different rooms and you say, well, that's where Paul had that. And you look over, that's where Paul's table was, his computer, and all these paintings will jammed up against the wall. They fill the whole place up with paintings and stacks from there. Now they've filled the garage up downstairs. And that's another issue down the track. What do we do with Paul's bits and pieces? I don't know.
So you've kept everything?
Mm-hmm. Everything. Clothes, everything, all stored downstairs in the garage. Paintings, drawings, prints. His press down there, his printing press is still down there. I don't know. That's another problem.
It is.
They'll deal with that
one day, yeah, when you need to. There are so many tasks that people have to do. It's physically exhausting. I mean, you've plastered hundreds of thousands, by your estimation, of posters. That takes an enormous toll physically, mentally, and emotionally. How have you managed that whole process? Because posters is kind of like the first step in a lot of this?
Well, you had posters. Well, okay. Sister used to run them off. She'd run them off at school and pay for them at school. Flyers. Gee, hundreds, thousands of flyers. And every time you put out 20,000 flyers, it's close to $2,000. And that's after you've searched everywhere. You make it for 1,800, 1,600 sometimes, then it goes up. Then you got to find someone else who'll do it a bit cheaper. Or he'll put them out there. But every time you did that, it was a lot of money built up.
And what other tasks have you had to perform over the years to spread the message? So there were posters, flyers.
Interviews. So something like these, interviews in newspapers, newspaper articles, radio interviews up the mountains.
Have you contacted any, like, members of parliament? Or? Oh,
members of parliament. This goes from the Premier, Deputy Premier, Minister of Transport, the minister who was in charge of the maritime and ferry services. Yes, letters to all of theirs, to them, asking, can I put posters on train stations? Can I put posters hanging on the train? I said, you've got space, you've got advertising on the trains and that there. Is there any way of getting posters of missing, not just Paul, but, you know, you put up four missing persons or whatever, and you got contact this advertising company who looks after all that, and then you go to them and they say, look, we can run a campaign for you, but that campaign is going to cost something like $8,000-$10,000 for a certain. I said, oh. You get from Ben and then you go back to the railways or something and they'll say, well, they control all that. We have no control over it. We can't do it. I said, what do you mean you have no control? It's your, it's our trains. You're running the trains for us. Surely the public has control over those, not some advertising company, but no. So you got all that. That's it. And then you go, I've been to the mayor, deputy mayor, councillors, Sydney. They were fine. They let me do whatever, basically what I wanted. There was a couple of really nice blokes down there, did everything you can. We were able to get the MPAN poster of Paul up outside of Circular Quay after a bit of hassles and that, and we worked on that, and we got the guys and that, and they finally came around and let us do it, and then they were happy really to let us put up anything we liked. You know, I wanted to put an A-frame up. They were happy to put a little A-frame up outside the Maritime Museum or something down there if you needed to, and they were always good, and I suppose I could go back to there again and revisit that.
It's good that you've had that kind of support from council, because I know a lot of people have had such a headache with trying to get their posters up around, you know, in the common spaces of any particular council, and council workers often just come around and pull them right down, and yet you see, you know, garage sale from 4 weeks ago, the poster's still on the telegraph pole, and it just boils my blood that that's another hurdle for many families where there's just no safe, secure, central spot for their posters to be seen by passers-by.
Well, when it gets down to it, you just got to persist, be persistent, let the water run off your back, just go for it and just keep doing it. Because I've actually asked the police, is there any law against any running posters up? And he said, well, no, there's not for this type of thing. We turn a blind eye to it because it's a public service in actual fact. It's not, you're not selling something.
I know that you guys went to men's shelters, maybe crisis accommodation, like we did the same for Dan. How was that whole process? Because there's a Privacy Act issue around that that, you know, isn't a huge obstacle for many families.
When we went to the shelters around Sydney, there's four or five main ones and that. I've contacted them. I went in and we gave them posters and said, look, do you mind if we won't hang them. Do you mind taking these posters and putting, well, if you can, maybe putting them up on your billboard or on somewhere here. If Paul was here, you would recognise him then, or because you just don't know who Paul's saying he is. They turn up to these shelters and they say, look, I'm John Smith, and in actual fact, I'm Paul Rushworth. They don't know. They don't question who you are or... So I gave them, they were quite happy, they were friendly, they took the posters and that, and Christmas time and that, I'd go in there and give them a couple of posters and, you know, give them a check or something or other to help them as well.
It's difficult in that scenario because you can understand, increasingly so, people are very protective and understandably of their privacy. And so in settings like, you know, men's shelter, crisis accommodation, a hospital, any of those services that many families of missing people look to, they aren't able to tell you whether or not they have been there or if they've seen them. I've gone and left notes that said, we can't tell you, but you know, if we happen to see him, we might be able to pass on a message. So, you know, you write this note and the thing is, you just need to know if they're okay.
Well, we'd been around to the hospitals and taking posters around and asked the hospitals and contacted, because some of the hospitals that we went to, they kind of were helping you. They'd help and they would have a look through their records and just see if anyone of that name came in, and they would tell you. Some hospitals we asked if we could put up some posters out of Parramatta and places around the hospitals there, oh, no, you can't put that up. And they said, well, no, it's a police matter. No, you can't hang those in the hospital or anything. And I said, well, my brother was saying to me, well, I don't really need to hang them. I just wanted someone to keep them in the office here. And if someone came in or that name came up on the computer, that you would be able to maybe just contact us and just say, look, okay, he's here, but you can't see him or whatever it is, blah, blah, blah. This is the reason why you can't, blah, blah, blah. That's all. Then I would have then gone from there. Then I would have gone to the police, obviously, and said to the police, look, we've found Paul. He's at such and such and such. And then they would take it from there and move in and talk to Paul and see what goes and whether or not he wanted to see myself or the family or anyone. It's up to them to take over. It wasn't me. But we were still trying to do that first step to get other people involved.
So how was the initial response from police when it came to searching for Paul?
Look, the girl that was in control of our one, she wasn't that old, not that old. A senior constable, but she was very helpful. She tried everything she can. She would listen. She'd listen. She'd tell this. She would listen to what I said. If she wasn't available, I would go higher up. I would talk to the sergeant, inspectors, and even to the point where I was talking to the superintendent of the actual station boss, and then they were very helpful and things like this. I've still got an email from her and that, and I haven't spoken to her from Redfern, but if they weren't, because a lot of time they're not around. This is the other problem too. The actual person or police officer who's in charge of looking after Paul's case, you know, they could be in court. They could be in court for 6 weeks, 2 months, and trying to contact them by email and things like this. And you think, oh, God, what's going on? So then I'd ring the police station and ask to speak to someone, and then get through to some other officer, and then they would go in and pull it up on the computer, look at the case study, and I'd say, okay, blah, blah, blah. And I say, well, look, I think we've had a sighting of Paul here, blah, blah, blah. Okay, look, that's great. And here's the name of the person who rang us and said they saw it, and they've got the phone number. I'm giving it to you. And they would go and then chase it up, and they always did, and they always got back to me and told me what the outcome was. So that was good. So the posters did get responses in King's Cross, in Paddington, around the city, parts around down the bottom of the Circular Quay, towards Circular Quay, and that. They did get some of the people were a bit strange. You got phone calls from some people who are a bit strange, but just don't worry about that.
How were you able to ascertain when potential sightings would come through and people would say things? Because you can't just chase after every possible lead. How did you know? What were the things that you were listening out for when they would describe the man that they'd seen that they thought might have been Paul?
Well, they'd describe what they saw on the poster.
Yeah, right.
So therefore, what are you going to say? They're looking at the poster, virtually sometimes standing in front of the poster describing Paul back to you. And we had Paul been sighted up at the, and the bloke, one bloke said he was speaking to Paul at a hotel up in Surrey Hills one night and blah, 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 blah. And he gives you a phone number. Sometimes I rang back and I couldn't get back onto him again, and so it's just that one there, you know, wasn't right. But other ones, you could tell in their voice they were genuine. They weren't all young; they were older people. They weren't being stupid. You could tell that. So then you just pass on, let the police. I just email either the officer in charge, or the girl in charge, or someone higher up. If I didn't get a response within a day or so, straight away, I'd go higher. And then they would say, okay, we'll send someone from from the city, or we'll send someone from King's Cross to go and check this out, where it was, where they sighted them, talk to them, and they'd have a look around. You can look around all you like. It's not easy, but I don't know what else they can do.
It's great that they even did that. I mean, often for cases like this where it's an adult male and, you know, there aren't any suspicious circumstances, they don't believe it's a homicide and there's no immediate threat of danger, they often don't prioritise cases like that. And that's perfectly understandable because it is an enormous volume of people in Australia that go missing every single day. I want to ask you about the if-onlys you touched on earlier with in regards to, I think it was the Blue Mountain CCTV at the station.
Not the Blue Mountain, down at Circular Quay. It was the police said that, look, I wanted to have a look at the CCTV footage for one thing and another, and they said, look, we've got CCTV footage of the station, around the station, in the station and towards the ferries and that. I said, well, as far as I know, he's ringing from outside, just outside the station. Now, have you got CCTV footage outside the station? You know, is this going back and forth with the police? And I says, you've got inside the station and down that way, but Paul was standing in the street 20 feet away from the station entrance. Have you got footage there? And they said, well, no, we haven't got it there, but can't see him anywhere. And I said, well, so then I said, well, it's got to be footage there somewhere. So I got then back onto the council and got onto who was in charge of all this too and blah, 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 and said, have you got CCTV footage of this down here, and to explain what it was and with time. But you know, and they had a quick look through all their files and that and checked it all out. By the time they checked it out and get back, you know, a couple of days, it's 2 or 3 days, the footage has already been run over. They've already copied over the top of it again. They don't just keep it. So that footage is lost in 10 days, 2 weeks, it's gone. So
it is very disheartening when the urgency isn't always understood.
And I blame myself thinking, well, maybe I should have acted quicker and demanded that. But I was thinking, well, if Paul rang from down there and he rang from a public telephone to here, surely the police can trace the call the other way and say exactly where he was when he rang. There was a week gone, virtually a week gone there, because they were still saying he was probably at Wynyard. And I was telling him, no, out there. So then I clicked, well, they must be able to trace back. They must be able to go. So I again emailed, talked to the constable and said, yeah, we'll see what we can do. Again, that's time. And by the time you find out that your Paul was at Circular Quay and there are cameras outside, it's too late. And then I said, well, hang on a second now. It may be too late for those cameras, but you've got McDonald's across the road and not far, just down the road, only, you know, 30 metres, not even that, down the road. They have footage. They would have footage outside, you know, the Blues or anything. They always have footage of outside their shops and doors and that. Maybe you could talk to them and see if they've got anything.
So you were asking police to ask them? You weren't just going directly to the businesses
themselves? No, I was trying to get them in to do it so that it's more official. And they went down. They had nothing. And they had no footage. It was just probably just that few days or so too late, and everything was just run over.
And you can't be too hard on yourself. You know, we're not investigators. You know, we're just thrust into this frantic situation and we've got a bajillion things to be doing all at once, and you're looking to police because they're the go-to, but I think there's also a lot of confusion around like what they are actually capable of. I think we have expectations of police that are based on what we've seen in the movies, and that's not generally realistic. So that's an issue, I think, for families to realise on day one, day five, week three, that, you know, understandably, and it's case by case, you know, some units will be better equipped than others, and circumstances are always going to be different, but it is an enormous task. And when it dawns on you that you're really the one in charge and you don't have that level of support that maybe you hoped for or expected, it's even more overwhelming.
That's it. It's very overwhelming. I was probably in the lucky position that we worked for ourselves, so I was able to find time to do these things and think and be on the computer a little bit and then start thinking about what else can we do? Where can we go from here? And it's been days, half your day sometimes, every day, looking back, doing this and then writing letters here. And
that's another thing. It takes up so much of your time. Like, I can't imagine. I just didn't go back to work, and I was very fortunate to be able to just drop everything. But people can't be expected to do that. I was lucky to have a very supportive partner, not put any pressure on me to go back to work. But when your loved one vanishes, you do everything in your power to try and find them. But, you know, if you've got an employer that doesn't really understand the urgency or your desperation, you're completely preoccupied, worrying about where your loved one is. So it is another factor in this crazy mess.
Well, that's right. That's a tough factor too, because to do the things you want to do and to do these places, you've got to be making the money over here as well and be shuffling this around here to pay for this.
Exactly. To pay the credit card of your missing loved one, to pay for the printing of the posters of your missing loved one. There are so many ramifications. On that, do you feel like it's, because there's a physical impact as well. Like, I feel like I have aged. I feel like I'm 200 years old. Like, I am grey on both sides and I blame Dan for that. And I've got all sorts of aches and pains in my joints and conditions. And I dare say that that's been brought on by the stress, because stress triggers a whole lot of things. Have you found any sort of physical outcomes of the stress that you've been under all these years since Paul disappeared?
I don't know. I think we all get older. We all feel older, and just I don't even think about that. I just keep going, keep going, keep going. That's all it is in your head. You just keep going, do this, help wherever you can, do whatever you can. Try to leave no stone unturned, and just look, keep going.
So the thought of slowing down or stepping back?
No.
Why? What would that signify?
It was Paul. It was mine. We were together, and that was it. And I made a promise to his mum too on her deathbed that I'd look after him. And I feel a little bit like I might let her down.
When was that? When was Paul's mum?
In 1990.
Was she over in England? Or?
No, she was here. She went over to England visiting some of her old relatives and that, and she type of got sick over there. You could tell she was sick over there, and she came back here. It wasn't that long after she came back, actually. She developed lung cancer and passed away very quickly. That was tough for Paul too, tough for all of us.
So she was totally fine with your relationship. She had no qualms.
She knew Paul was gay from
day one.
Yeah, basically. He was, but he wasn't out there. But you couldn't tell. But she knew. I think mothers know and fathers know. They're not silly. You don't have to tell them anything. They know.
Do you think there were any implications around this situation when Paul goes missing and you've got to, or you feel you've got to put it out there publicly and you've got to deal with the media and you've got to deal with the police and you've got to deal with the public? Was that ever a concern that people would cast judgment or respond differently?
No, I just really, I couldn't care less what people think about that side of things. That's not the issue. The sexuality is not the issue. It's the way two human beings feel about each other, and one's missing, and it's a missing person. It's not a missing gay person, or it's not a missing heterosexual person. It's just a missing person. So there's no questions there.
Did you worry that the publicity in the beginning, when you were putting posters up everywhere, that Paul might see a poster and freak out, and that it could actually be a deterrent for him making contact with you?
You did think of that, and I thought of that a lot. That's just the risk you got to take. What are you going to do? Do nothing. It's a risk you take that if he sees the poster. What I was thinking, the other way I thought about it, well, if Paul sees a poster, then someone also sees a poster might also see Paul not far or in that area. That's that option too, that you may actually find him as well that way. And hanging up posters was, you met a lot of different people. Some people would come up, they'd come up to you and they were very friendly. I had one doctor, one I was hanging up posters not far from the hospital there at King's Cross. And this doctor came up, she said, look, she was interested and she started speaking to me, and she was a psychiatrist and she says, look, I'm really sorry to see this, but I'll be honest with you, I kind of see this every day, this type of thing. And I was talking to her and she says, well, with sometimes with some mental issues and that, you can be fine that day. And your brain can just click over like this, and all of a sudden you've got problems, and you're spiraling down. She says, "I see it every day in the clinic I'm in," and that's the way it probably was with Paul's type of thing. He didn't really show; he was a bit anxious and that beforehand, but not over anxious or anything like this.
Was he on any medication? Had he been diagnosed with anything? No.
No, he's on no medication. The doctor, Paul's saying he wasn't sleeping very well. He wasn't that, so that he went up and saw the doctor. The doctor gave him some, half a dozen sleeping tablets type of thing to use when he needed to. And Paul was this bloke. He was actually scared about taking medication. I says, well, don't, if you don't want it, don't take it. Well, just take half of one. I said, okay, well, just take half of one. Don't take a full one. So he was that way inclined. So he didn't. This is what was leading up to him. I said, well, that was thought was strange that he wanted to go get more sleeping tablets because he wasn't that way inclined to take tablets and pills and things like this. He didn't do it.
You also said you don't think he was that way inclined in regards to suicide, which is an obvious connection that many people make with missing persons. So you never had the feeling, I mean, you know Paul better than anyone.
I still don't believe. Even on the day that I was speaking with him on the phone that morning, he did actually say to me, I might have to do something more drastic. And I says, look, Paul, that's silly. What are you thinking of doing? There's no point. If I can't get the sleeping tablets, I might have to think about something more drastic. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said. Then he said to me, "I haven't got the guts to do it." And I believed it. I believed, and I still believe that he never wouldn't do it. Didn't have the guts to do it. He just, I couldn't see it.
And like I said, you know him better than anyone. When you don't have any evidence or proof to show otherwise, there is always going to be hope, which is a great thing, but it's also bloody exhausting to be clinging onto hope.
It's all it is. It's hope always, because when Paul went missing there, he didn't drive. He wasn't driving. He says, well, how far can you go? How far can you go around Sydney and disappear without a trace? And things would go through my mind, okay, he's gone to the gap and, jumped off, but they always find you. I just couldn't believe they wouldn't find something if he did that. But, so that's why I never in my come across that. I wouldn't even think about that.
Have police ever asked you to help them get DNA on the system?
Yes.
And that's been done?
Yes, that was done earlier on. We actually got they came and collected it from the unit. They took his toothbrush, comb, hairbrush and that. They would get them, and then I go down to the doctors and get information off him and his dental records. And then, of course, he had no relatives in Australia, and the closest one would have been his half-sister. They get Interpol involved, and they get DNA samples from her on the paternal side. so that if something turns up anywhere, they've type of got the DNA side of things covered.
They've been very thorough. It's good to have faith in that system because it's just one of many, many systems that exist and sort of, I guess, support families in this predicament. But it sounds like they have been really thorough with you from the get-go, which is great.
I think it gets down to push, and if you've got the right police officer looking after the case, the constable I was dealing with, she was very nice. She did everything she had to do, everything I asked her to do. She kept in contact with me for years and years. I don't hear much from her now. She did email me, wishing me Merry Christmas. What did you do over Christmas? She came from Orange and she was a country girl and she was moved around the state a little bit, so I didn't hear a lot from her, but she'd still come back. I don't know. I suppose when we get to the coroner's court this year, she'll probably be there.
And how did you find out that was, what's the process like? It takes years. I mean, state by state, but so you were just recently informed that Paul's case is before the coroner.
Over 12 months ago, you talked to the constable. She keeps telling you, like, I've basically got the evidence together. She's got it together and then she sends it off to the coroner and then you just wait and you sit in that and you don't hear anything. One day I got a phone call at work from the coroner's court saying, oh, blah, 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 I'm so-and-so from the coroner's court. Paul Rushworth's case is going to come up sometime in the next 12 months or so. Have you got, this is what you said, have you got any preference of when it is? And I says, well, no, what difference is it going to make to me? So she said, okay, then we'll just inform you in the sometime over the next 12 months. Well, I finally got a letter about 18 months afterward. Only I actually got a letter probably a month ago now saying that it's just a formal letter saying, hi, Paul Rushwood, Coroner's Court, 22nd July, 10 a.m. That's it.
Do you know what to expect?
No. Oh, well, we've had people with the family, friends of missing person. When you go to those type of things, there's always someone from the coroner's court comes in and tells you a little bit about things and that, and they say you can have this and you can have, if you want someone to represent you. I'm saying, well, why? what's someone going to sit here, a solicitor or a barrister going to sit here, going to do anything? Are you just going to? So I'm thinking. I was looking at my sister and said, well, why would you want all that? So, obviously, you're just going to go in there. They're going to obviously ask you if you want to say anything or say anything. I don't know. What are you going to say? So basically, they're just going to make it a judgment based on whatever evidence they have in front of them, and they can make a judgment whatever they like. That's not going to make any difference to me.
So there's nothing outstanding? Because I often think, you know, really, only a death certificate can sometimes be useful when it comes to closing accounts or, you know, various administrative issues can be taken care of with a death certificate. But otherwise, a lot of the time, you know.
That's right. And then I could be in there and they may not say, give you a death certificate. So then that doesn't mean it's meaningless. So then obviously I'm going to then, after that, then have to look at, well, oh, they're going to go to the Supreme Court then and get something from the Supreme Court to deal with Paul's assets and things like this, and where do we put them or place them or something? I don't know. We'll work that one out. And the Tubblers, neither of us had wills. That money just sitting there in limbo at the moment until his assets are just sitting there in limbo until we can... I don't care. They can sit there as long as they like. I don't care. But eventually the government will take it.
Well, how do you prevent that from happening? Surely you get to apply as a long-term partner.
Eventually, yes, right. That's what I'm assuming. And but I was waiting until you get everything from something comes up from the coroner's court. That then we'll deal with that issue down the track, and I'll either talk to the Justice Department and see through the family and friends of missing persons, maybe they can do something too.
Do you think it could be problematic? Like, did you register your relationship? I know that that's something up until 2015, when same-sex marriage was finally legalized in Australia, that was really the next best thing, was to register, you know, your relationship. You guys didn't do that. There was no need, obviously. Do you think that could pose a problem in that process, you know, when you do?
Well, I can't see how it can pose a problem if the police and everyone else and they're assuming me as being the next of kin. Why is now all of a sudden a problem?
Well, it would be the last thing that anyone would need, but I'm sure that happens all the time.
It just depends. I don't think it's going to be an issue. Just see what happens. We'll just deal with that when it comes to it.
Do you think that there could be positives from the coronial process?
No. What positive are you going to get?
Well, sometimes people think that there will be answers. That, you know, it does, because they take a deeper look at things and they can make recommendations to police, and it's a more thorough investigation from my experience, which is very limited. But sometimes people do want the coronial process to get underway so that they can get answers, and it can sometimes seemingly put a bit more pressure on the police investigating the matter to look at things a bit more closely.
Well, that's what they are supposed to do. That's their job, but they don't ever come to you. You know, you don't see anything until that day. Obviously, you're going to sit in that court for an hour, whatever it takes, and that's the first time you're going to hear anything from the coronial courts. You hear nothing else except this letter and blah, blah, blah. This is, you're going to turn up on this day type of thing, and then that's it. You don't hear anything. They don't say, oh, by the way, Peter, we've found this out and we've found this out, we've found this out.
Do you think if the coroner does conclude that Paul has passed away, that that's going to affect the way that your family and friends respond to this? Are they going to have the same vigour? Many of your family members are still helping you put up posters fairly, you know, frequently. Do you think that if an official document says it's unlikely that Paul is still alive, that you'll still have that same level of support from people doing those physical tasks? You will?
Yes, I think so, yeah. I know my family.
Because I think a lot of the time people, and I can understand why it happens when it's been a while and then there's an official document and people want resolution. Human beings aren't comfortable with lingering uncertainty. And so friends and family might say, you know, it's time to move on now. We've got this result, and that's going to be easier for you. You know, people want it to be easier for you. They want to alleviate the burden, but
that's not going to make any difference. It's just a piece of paper. It's just a piece of paper saying that either Paul's passed away, or there's no piece of paper. They may not say anything. I don't know. They may just leave it open. That could be then open for, I could be dead by the time they close. Who knows?
But do you think it could help, would it get easier, do you think, for you in the future if you did have...
No, it won't make any difference.
It doesn't get any easier, does it?
No. It's still the same. Nothing's changed. What's going to change? It's just someone else's opinion. Okay, they may look at evidence the police have gathered, but it's only what they've gathered. Still, they don't know your feelings and what you believe.
And if you believe that Paul is still alive and then all of a sudden this official document says otherwise, my concern would have been that people therefore go, it's unlikely that he's alive, therefore we don't need to be searching for him as much, that the public would kind of give up and move on. And I was always terrified of that. And I think it's really challenging for families to be able to communicate that regardless of whether or not someone says they're dead or alive, and whether or not they are, in fact, dead or alive, they still need to be found.
That case, the only ones will know that actually I've been to the coroner's court will be my family, immediate family. I won't. No one else will know. I won't put it out there.
It's a public document, though, and that's part of it.
But people have got to go and look for that public document. If I don't say anything, then they don't know, and I'll just keep going and keep putting up posts if I need to and keep moving on. The public won't know unless they actually search for it.
What are birthdays like, birthdays and anniversaries? Do you mark anniversaries? Is that a thing that you're conscious of?
Yes. I don't mark it, but I know that one this year was a leap year, and Paul and I met on the 29th of February, so I knew that's a special day type of thing. And so you just think about him a little bit more. That's all. And you think, oh, that day stays there. Don't do anything special or anything like this, but you just think a bit more about him.
Milestones more difficult? It would have been his 50th birthday a couple of years ago. What's that day like?
Milestones like that. With Paul, we tried to do little special things every birthday, so it didn't make any difference really, 50th or that. We probably would just done something special. I don't know. I used to sometimes take him away and did helicopter flights and things and sky jumping.
Wow.
For his birthday one year. I didn't do it, but he made him do it.
Thrill seeker.
So that was quite funny, and I think there's still a video downstairs of him in the plane, and he looks a bit worried.
Understandably so, yes.
But I did things like that for him just to make the day a little bit special. Other times we just do go to shows, special shows or something. Let's have a nice dinner and just to make it something special, because he only had me and my family. So he had friends, but he was a bit more of a loner. And then when we have get together as a family, we have a cake or something or other.
What about with historic moments, like, for instance, when same-sex marriage was finally legalised here in Australia? Do you think about, on that day, how Paul and you would have responded to that together? Does it make it bittersweet with events like that?
We've probably been happy, but I don't know whether or not we would have done it. I don't know.
That was not something that you ever talked about?
No,
because 28 years, yeah,
but,
really?
Yeah, but that's mean. You had 28 years. You didn't need to talk about that. You didn't need to worry about that. You were set.
Yeah.
You didn't need a piece of paper to say that we were together.
No, but even the acknowledgement of it, like, even if, you know, you don't want to get married, but there are moments in history that, you know, they happen when your loved one is still missing and you're not sharing them together.
Oh,
and
dear,
you feel, yeah.
Yeah. You do think that way. You think, well, that was a special time that we may have on the spur of the moment said, well, let's do it. Who knows? We could have said, oh, great, let's do it and make it legit.
28 years is pretty legit. Yeah, you're right. Are there specific changes that you would like to see in areas that, you know, could be improved in your experience with this? So with the police, with the media, and with the way that, you know, different support services get around you?
Police, I think they're probably doing what they're trained to do a little bit, and then they probably follow the book. The book says do this, do this, do this, 1, 2, 3, 4. Instead of in their own heads and own hearts, they say, well, maybe I should do this, and maybe I should go a little bit, step out a little bit and think, what if I had someone go missing? What would I do? How would I cope? What would be the things that I would look at first of all? And of course, every case is different, so that's what they need to do. They need to move away from being this and then think about putting themselves in that position and go from there. And they'll figure out, oh, maybe these things are all right, but we also need to do all this, this, this and this straight away.
What about the way that the public responds to this, or the way that people, you know, there's a perception around missing persons as a topic, as an issue. Do you want to see that change in any way?
Yes, you need to get more information, and that's where your organisation comes in, MPAN. They get out there. They're out there in people's faces. Everyone on Facebook, here and here, and they're doing, you do a wonderful job, you do a great job. People need to understand that sometimes people, they go missing, but they're not sure why they go missing. And they need, some people need a lot of help. You look at some families and you think, well, I'm sorry, but they're going to struggle. They just haven't. They just need help left, right and centre all over the place, or they're just going to get trampled on. And that's scary and that's worrying. That's why I do, to try to help whenever I can. Put it out there that people just forget about anything and just do it. Just have a go. Do whatever you think you're comfortable with doing, and don't worry what anyone else is thinking, or just go for it.
That's why it's so wonderful to have you as such a powerful advocate and spokesperson for Paul and for people like you by getting involved with our campaigns, because I know it's extremely taxing to have to go through these stories over and over, but to know that there are so many people out there who are going to resonate and connect and feel seen and heard and understood when typically they're not given that chance because it's all about their loved one and they're kind of forgotten. They're forgotten about. So it is really important that we get opportunities like these where people outside of this community that no one ever wants to belong to get that insight into just what it's like. And it's hell, but there are always positives that can come out of it. So having people like you involved with projects like these makes a huge difference. So thank you so much for coming along.
No, like, I need to thank you for letting me come along and talk and tell my story.
When the rain pelts against Peter's window, he sees Paul marching home, his hair soaked to the scalp, clothes clinging to his skin, and his grey eyes shining with purpose. Peter sees Paul pressing coins into every phone box he passes, leaning in to say his last goodbye, and he wants to rest Paul's head on his chest and whisper that it's all going to be all right. He imagines Paul's hair lift in the breeze on Circular Quay when he hangs up the phone, the harbour bridge behind him, and feels like the lament of his own soul could scream throughout the Opera House. He's covered every inch of Sydney and ventured further still to find him. Night after night, he drove, searching like he'd never searched before, hoping like he'd never hoped, wishing like he'd never wished. And through the darkest valley he's ever known, he kept telling himself that surely it would eventually end. Paul would come back, even if it was to just let him know he was all right. Those were the first weeks, months, years. Peter is still waiting. He once watched a television program explaining a thought experiment called Schrödinger's cat. Depending on how you look at it, a cat in a closed box could either be alive or dead. It's only upon observation that the cat's true state can be determined. So up until the moment of truth, the cat is both dead and alive. Peter has exhausted every possible outcome of Paul's disappearance. He could be dead. He could be alive. But in real terms, it can only be one. And until the moment of truth, he chooses alive and feels it with every beat of his heart. In his favourite conclusion that he keeps returning to, he imagines Peter riding the waves of the Pacific on a super yacht, his bronzed bare feet on the teak decking, his hands around the ship's wheel. He sees dolphins jumping, seagulls swirling in the wind, the sun kindling Paul's maritime crusade. Circled by horizon, enclosed by the sky, afloat on the ocean, he's free. The nautical odyssey nourishes his soul, heals his pain, keeps him floating through space. Paul Rushworth's episode was adapted from original writing by Jeremy Massey. Missing Persons Advocacy Network is an unfunded charity run by me, Lauren O'Keefe. In 2016, we started a project that paired authors and artists with Australian families to tell their stories, to humanise missing loved ones beyond the stats they're typically reduced to. Though it grew to comprise murals, songs, sculptures, documentaries, and coffee cups, our modern take on the old milk carton campaigns of the 80s, it began with a book called Two Short Stories. The What's Missing podcast was inspired by that book. These stories are but some of thousands. Help us help the usually unseen, unheard, forgotten community of those left behind by heading to our website where you can donate or get involved, mpan.com.au. That's mpan.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter using the same handle, mpanaus. That's mpanaus. If you have a missing loved one, check out our guide at missingpersonsguide.com.